Once we get somebody who has presented us with a problem on a personal level that may deal with mental health, that may be acute, we not only need to be caring and open and receptive and good listeners, but we also need to have a good understanding of what resources are available. We took this job to help all people, and this is that moment when we get to do that within as well as outside of our organizations. No firefighter should lose their job or take their life because we have failed to provide help. And that sums up the entire initiative here.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Battalion Chief Christian Hinojosa of the Dallas Fire Department on the topic of mental health awareness for the company officer, the signs, the symptoms, and the strategies. This episode is sponsored by the Angio Foundation. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Respond to Resilience. We're on Facebook, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and you can find us on our website, respondertv.com. Catch all the latest information and past episodes. We'll be right back to speak with Christian after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Lumley, LCSW, EMTB. And we'd like to introduce a topic that's been going around in some of our circles, and it seems critically important, especially for leaders, supervisors, and officers who are charged with the responsibility of the well-being of their members. And that specifically has to do with their mental health wellness. So on this topic, we were fortunate enough to connect with Christian Hinojosa, who is a battalion chief at the Dallas Fire Department. He's been a public servant for 17 years, and he's led the second largest DFD employee association, representing over 450 firefighters. So this role has carried substantial political and administrative responsibilities and has included extensive interaction with the Dallas Fire Command Staff, the City Council, and the City Manager on a regular basis. Welcome to Respond to Resilience, Christian.
Thank you, David. Good to be here today.
It's nice to have you.
Yeah, thank you, Bonnie. You know, this is such an important topic in the fire service, and, so much of what we're trying to do to move the ball down the field is having these exact types of conversations, you know, really getting the dialogue going. Breaking the stigma is not something that just happens because you want it to happen. It requires a deliberate and proactive approach. So I'm really glad to be part of this process here today specifically.
Well, we're looking forward to hearing some of your approach and ideas. Just to jump right in, can you talk to us a little bit about your role at your current department and what you do in leadership there?
Absolutely. Just started my 18th year with Dallas Fire Rescue in October, and currently served as a battalion chief in our emergency operations bureau. I have seven fire stations under my command, about 60 firefighters. And that's my day-to-day responsibilities. But my career has provided ample opportunities to serve, not just in a forward-facing role, but also internally amongst our first responders who are near and dear to my heart.
Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations on your promotion.
Thank you. And
we're really wondering why you're so passionate about mental health for firefighters. What got you on this path?
You know, about 7 years ago, I was afforded an opportunity to take the helm of one of our unions in Dallas. And in that capacity, I went from primarily serving citizens to also now serving firefighters. And really at that point recognized that we have a really unique population that requires a certain type of response, if you will. There's a lot of parallels to what we're doing when the bell hits, but to serve this population required a lot of awareness of what was going on. And in leading a union, you realize that it's not all just about providing window stickers and representing people at internal affairs. It's about firefighters who are struggling, who are going through a crisis of their own, who may have family issues, who need a different type of support. What's really unique about the fire service, it's a collection of men and women who have dedicated their life to service. And we're all drawn to this career, in part because we want to serve. You know, so often you ask a firefighter who's going through the interview process, well, why do you want to do this job? And it may sound cliche, but the answer is often that I want to help people. And we have to get back to that. We have to remember why we're all here. And so leveraging that desire to serve the community lends itself well to also serving the internal community that we have with our first responders. So as I was tasked with leading the union, I recognize that there's a whole lot of needs that we have. I will also say that we were going through a period of crisis in our own department's history with mental health and trauma and suicide. And, when you're interfacing with internal affairs, as you represent your employees, you realize that people get introduced into the internal affairs network because they've done something wrong. And a lot of times what they've done is largely a symptom, but not necessarily the root cause or the underlying issue. You know, we have a lot of interaction with internal affairs with drug and alcohol use. And so when we start looking at that, we're not trying to punish somebody for drinking, although we do have to have a standard of operational readiness in the fire service. But we really want to dive a little bit deeper and see what is it that got the person introduced to internal affairs. So, you know, through the association, through looking at the state of the organization, of the agency and where we were, and then through some personal experiences of my own and my own background, those were the three legs of the stool that really got me passionate about mental health for our firefighters.
When it comes to occupational cancer exposures, members of the fire service are some of the highest risk professionals nationwide. Firefighters Against Cancer and Exposures, also known as the FACES Foundation, is an advocacy organization established to bring awareness, resources, and peer support to responders in need of additional help in battling potential cancer diagnoses or critical concerns. The FACES Foundation was established by a national alliance of first responders to offer supplemental resources for firefighters. One of its core initiatives is cancer awareness in the form of prevention and early detection, supporting vigilance about occupational cancers and cancer recurrence through our national Get Checked Now campaign. Also, the FACES Foundation publishes a major public catalog of resources for the many areas of need, including information on clinical and mental health therapies, benefits and compensations, funding sources and financial strategies. For more information, please visit the FACES website at facesusa.org.
You really have a dual role in leadership there, not only with the union, but also as battalion chief and formerly as a captain. And as you mentioned, so there's what aspect of your background has shaped your desire to be of service to your fellow firefighters in the capacity that you are?
Sure. You know, educationally, psychology has always been of interest to me. It was what I chose to major in for my undergraduate studies. Mm-hmm. And so academically, I always had an interest in what makes us tick as human beings. And then, you know, as my own career unfolded in the fire service and I experienced the highs and the lows, the ups and downs of being a first responder, you know, for all of the joy that we experience in having a job that we look forward to going to on our days off. And that's by and large what I hear from firefighters and what my own experience has been. We are also exposed to a tremendous amount of trauma. Physiologically, we have a lot going on with sleep deprivation. You know, most firefighters are struggling with some kind of chronic physical pain. You know, I mean, I can tell you my neck, my back, my wrists, my knees, my feet, you know, they all have aches and pains after doing this for, you know, 17 plus years. The sleep deprivation's probably one of the biggest ones, though, physiologically. Our bodies are constantly in a state of elevated stress, cortisol. So physiologically, we're also all a little bit off. And then, you know, the stresses of the job, what you see and do. We're learning so much more now about PTSD, but also about what we call RET, which is a repeated exposure to trauma. You know, you look at the military population and they will, in combat, they'll often have acute PTSD. And that combat may be, you know, 1 month, 6 months, maybe a couple of tours, but it's never going to be a, you know, generally you're not going to be a combat military person for 20 or 30 years. What we notice in the fire service is it's not uncommon to have careers that go a full 30 years. Mm-hmm. And throughout those 30 years, almost every 3 days, you may have had some kind of exposure to a traumatic experience. So that repeated exposure to trauma personally had taken a toll. And my own coping mechanisms, as I went through my career, were not always healthy. You know, there was, you know, I was trying to self-medicate with alcohol. You know, I was not keeping my guard up and maintaining a good regimen of exercise and nutrition. You know, I wasn't talking about what so many of us call our demons, you know, and it had an effect on my physical health. It had an effect on my family, had an effect on the relationships in my life. And so going through that myself, in my opinion, qualified me, and as I kind of emerged from a period of my own life and my own career that was difficult, that was not being handled with appropriate coping mechanisms, and came through that and was shown something different and was given a new set of tools to pick up and to deploy. And now, you know, having done that, for a good number of years, I do feel like the experiences that I've had are now to be used for the benefit of my peers. And I remember I was in the thick of it, and I remember having a conversation with somebody who's near and dear to me, our chaplain, Elaine Maddox, and I was hurting. I really was. I was in a dark place, and I remember Elaine just walking side by side with me. And she just whispered something, and she said, you know, Christian, one day, you may not see it right now, but one day God is going to use this experience to help others. And that prophecy could not have been more true at that time. You know, coincidentally, today, is my 6-year anniversary of being free of alcohol. So November 16th is
congratulations.
Yeah. So it's a special time to get to have this conversation with you guys as well.
Well, you made an interesting point before. All first responders are having a deployment all the time, and then they need to go home to their family and act like nothing happened. You know, and how do you vacillate between the two extremes all the time? And we talk about that a lot on this show. And I think that in and of itself is absolutely exhausting. And then you add the repetitive nature and everything else.
And I would say the other piece is quite frequently combat veterans become firefighters. And so they've now got the two layers of accumulated trauma, probably makes for them even more difficult than the rest of us.
Yeah. That's when we get into complex PTSD. Mm-hmm. And I would say they join all branches of first responder world, mm-hmm. EMS, police as well. So when you think about where we are now and where we need to be with mental health, what do you think we need to do to bridge that gap? We're talking about it, which is a piece of that, but what else do you think has to be done to get us where we should go?
Sure. Specific to the fire service, my observations are there's three components to that question. The first is you have to have top-down organizational support. And I'm talking about the command staff as well as city leadership. So in a department the size of Dallas, it's critical that we have city council, the city manager, the mayor, supporting this effort for police and fire. But the next, that also includes having a command staff that is not just giving lip service to it, but that has some buy-in. And we've been really fortunate. Our current fire chief and our previous fire chief have both really made it a priority on their agenda and backed that up. And so the second portion that's necessary is to have, the funding and the resource allocation. You could have a lot of good intentions and a lot of good ideas and talk a lot. But at the end of the day, when you start building out the infrastructure of mental health support, of resilience, you're going to need a team. You're going to need clinicians. You're going to need to have certain categories of leave that are afforded to your employees so that when they do go through something and they do, raise that white flag and say, I can't anymore, that you can institutionally support what they're needing and what they're asking for. And finally, I'd say, this is one of the most important pieces, is you have to have buy-in. I'd say, ideally you want a department-wide buy-in for this initiative, for these goals. But a good starting place, from my own experience, is you need to have buy-in from your company officers. So if you look at the fire service, mm-hmm. your captains and lieutenants interface with the vast majority of your firefighters on every given day. Your company and your engine and your ladder truck officers, they are responsible for work groups throughout the city. 60 of those work groups are working today in Dallas, and all of them have an officer, and that officer has a very unique and a keen awareness of his or her work group. And so really focusing the cultural change on that level in the rank structure, to me, is essential, because they are also the ones who are influencing the ones beneath them.
Right.
So to have that company level officer buy-in, I think, is the third component in really moving the ball down the field.
If I can share my experience and help just one person, or help one person help somebody else, that's what it's all about.
We're trying to break down the stigma. We're trying to share that there are great, effective resources out there.
Vulnerability is a strength. It's not a weakness.
What I've heard from all of the subjects in my film is that I think my story can help someone else.
And as police officers, we always want to go in, see problem, fix problem. And you can't do that with a mental health crisis. You have to see person and connect with person.
This sucks, but I'm going to have to embrace this suck. You know, I don't like these cards, but these are the cards that I've been dealt, and I'm going to have to play them to the best of my ability. And I've been trying to do that for the last 10 years.
And I agree with you 100% on that. You know, I have a little bit of a, on a lesser scale, but I was the captain, which in our service is chief of service, to about 50. And when I was in that role for the 2 years, I tried really, really hard to create a culture of this being acceptable to talk about. We get someone in if we need it. We do referrals if we need them. And I constantly brought this up as a topic, probably more than anybody else, because I wanted to make sure I was giving everyone permission to think about it, to talk about it. And some people don't want to, but at least if the culture, what you're saying is the culture allows for it to be okay to look at this topic and then to get help if needed. And I saw it really changed how people viewed what they could do to get support, and it normalized everything. And we took the stigma away because we gave the permission. Mm-hmm. And probably harder, obviously, in a huge department because you have a lot more players and leaders to get on board, but it seems like just such a critical part.
It is. It is. And one of the things about the fire service that's unique is that we're in a residential environment in our firehouses. And that's what they used to call them, the firehouse. And that house is populated 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the most unique job out there based on just that fact. You know, the vast majority of the American workforce does not understand what it means to live with a group of people for a 24-hour period. You know, you're having three meals with this group. Mm-hmm. You're doing chores together. You're doing training together. You're relaxing together. And then that's all independent of doing the job together. When that bell hits, there is this, you know, choreographed response with this team where everybody relies on each other and trusts each other with their life to go into any number of dangerous situations and come back, you know, together. And we're all looking out for each other. So that, you know, again, going back to the company officer, that company officer has a really special and unique responsibility and vantage point to care for and to be aware of what's going on with his or her work group. And I would say, you know, as we talk about mindfulness and about resilience, one of the things that I personally strive to do and really hope that others will do is to get present. You know, so many of us in this day and age have gotten hooked on this little thing that takes our attention away, you know, from human connection. You know, I'm always so proud when I see a work group together having dinner and nobody's on their phone. Hmm. You know, and always kind of disappointed when you walk into a room and nobody's talking and everybody is captivated by this 4-inch screen, you know.
In some cases, you know, shifts, work groups are not even having dinner together. They just do their own thing. They go to their own separate parts of the firehouse. And that's probably the, you know, the least cohesive scenario for what you're talking about. And I think what's critical, and I'd love to know your thoughts on this, as a company officer, like how can we be more aware, more present, and recognize when somebody is struggling with a mental health or other problem? Like, what are some of the signs, symptoms, and behaviors that might be signaling that they need help?
Sure. You know, I spent 10 years of my career as a company officer, and it was some of the most rewarding. It was the most rewarding years because of the relationships and the bonds that I built with my firefighters. I haven't been a battalion chief that long, but there has not been a day gone by that I have not missed my previous role for that specific reason. But I would say, you know, before answering your question, David, the first thing is that an officer needs to be present, needs to be aware, and really needs to be modeling that behavior that is expected. That means, you know, the officer, you know, again, this is my opinion, the officer should not be coming into work, you know, tired and hungover, and then expect that his or her work group is going to be fully up to speed. But beyond that, I would say, you know, the signs and symptoms, we are in such a unique role to observe. You know, I remember, you know, with my crew as a captain, I could come into work, you know, and before we even say a word, I actually know what's going on with my crew. You know, I don't need to even talk to them. Their energy and their body language already tells me everything I need to know. So I would say that having an awareness of who we work with and being present is an important component. The signs and symptoms are going to vary. I don't think there's a generic response to that question. Obviously, if somebody is withdrawn, if somebody is showing up to work and doing the bare minimum to get their gear on the rig and then going back to lay down and sleep, I think if somebody is expressing frustration or anger, you know, maybe in having to make a run, or maybe the way they're driving, I think all of those are signs and symptoms that we have to be paying attention to. But I think most importantly is we have to pay attention to when somebody starts acting different, you know, and it requires a lot of awareness, because one of the things we hear so frequently in and out of the fire service with the suicide and suicide attempts is, I had no idea that this was going on with that person. This is such a surprise. So the, you know, the quandary is how do we start having a better idea? And again, I go back to, you know, providing organizational support, providing mid-level management support, and having the conversations. You know, the silver lining to every crisis we've had with our firefighters that I've observed is that it leads to additional conversations, you know, some forced, some awkward, some compulsory, because it may be a CISM type of format. But the fact of the matter is, we're having more conversations. That's a good thing.
This episode is sponsored by the Angio Foundation, a public trust supporting first responder health and safety through prevention and early detection of cancer.
I think you're right about the leadership needing to know their people, because we all know there are places where that doesn't happen. you know, and the leaders are there for their own narcissism or, you know, to look powerful, and they're not there maybe for the right reasons. But I think the people who are, it takes a lot of effort and energy on their part to make that extra time to stop in, you know, if you're in a big city department and you have several stations, to stop in and really know who those people are. But then the captains on the shifts, you know, knowing what's going on in Joe's life right now. You know, is he having marital troubles? Is something going on with a kid? And genuinely caring about those people and asking what's happening. Because I think when people feel validated and heard, they're more likely to discuss what's going on with them. If they feel like they're in an environment where they need to keep it quiet and keep it hidden and just do their protocols and do their trainings, you know, they're not going to ever invite that into the workplace. So I think you're right. It really is top down. And any of those differences, you're going to see it. And you see when, because we live so closely together on those shifts, you're a little family. So when somebody all of a sudden starts excusing themselves or goes and sleeps during the day, and they never did that before, to me, that's going to be a red flag.
Big time.
Right?
Big time.
And you mentioned others, like coming in late or coming in looking exhausted. You know, I used to try to make sure I checked out all the people I was with on my crew before I even touched any gear, because the gear is worthless if our brain is not in order.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and you mentioned the idea of a family. I mean, if you have a spouse that works a regular schedule and you're a firefighter and that spouse is gone from, let's say, 8 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday, you start tallying up the hours, we're actually spending, in many cases, more time with our fire family than we are with our own family. So it is, and that's, like I said, that's one of the biggest blessings of this job, is we have a work environment that is based on fellowship, that is based on a team, that can be a tremendous amount of fun. As anybody who's worked in a firehouse knows, it's a blast.
Well, some of the impetus for this topic is from personal experience, where perhaps in the fire service and the other emergency services, as emerging officers, we're not getting the training or the tools to kind of give us the awareness we need to have these conversations, to even be aware, to know what to do, to know how to approach somebody. And I think in this conversation, I'd love to shed some light on that from your personal experience, Christian, like in your role as a captain, and probably also as a battalion chief, like what are some of the things that you found work in terms of approaching somebody you sense is having a problem? How do you have that conversation with them? And then how do you take action to get them help?
Sure. You know, just like in making an emergency run, the emergency run is mitigated not based on what happens at the present time, but it's based on largely based on what has happened prior to that. So in the fire service, we call that pre-incident planning. And you know, I love the fire department because it provides so many useful parallels and metaphors for what we're trying to do here with mental health. So the pre-incident planning is, to me, the first step in the answer to your question. We have to have invested in our people prior to some kind of crisis coming about. So that when the bell hits, we've already got some history. We already know, you know, I know that, you know, I know Peter's family. I know what's going on with his kids. You know, I know Mike's situation. I know, you know, I've already invested that time. So to me, it starts way before there's an issue or a crisis. And it involves taking the time to get to know your people. It involves being present. Now, what happens when all of a sudden we do find ourselves dealing with or having to care for somebody who is in crisis? You know, the first the first fork in the road, obviously, is this person safe? Is are they safe for themselves and for other people? And if they're not and they're at work, we, you know, we also have a responsibility to maintain operational readiness, mm-hmm. and to make sure that we're able to effectively do our jobs. And so obviously, you know, as any officer or any chief, you know, has to be able to rely on their people to do the job and to do the job that's going to require potentially quite a bit out of the firefighter. So if they're, you know, a danger to self or others, we're going to have a very specific response. If they're not, and my own experience is that more often than not, we're dealing with chronic issues. We're dealing with a slow, gradual decline in performance, in health. And so to me, it's obviously, you know, going back to that relationship, investing in the relationship. If I've done that, it's a lot easier for me to have a conversation. Hey, come on into the office. Like, let's just chat. How are you? What's going on with you? I just want to do a check-in, you know, and so often we may brush that off. We may think we're not going to be effective. We may be too busy. But just starting the dialogue, you know, and a lot of times, you know, firefighters, they've got a sense of competence and an ego based on the fact that the public relies on us to fix whatever problem they're having. And it could be a very simple or a very complex problem. But when they call for you, you're tasked with solving a problem. And by and large, you know, at least in Dallas, we do a dang good job of that. Once we get somebody who has presented us with a problem on a personal level that may deal with mental health, that may be acute, that may exceed our capacity, we not only need to be caring and open and receptive and good listeners, but we also need to have a good understanding of what resources are available. So somebody comes to me, you know, I have a passion for this, but I'm not a licensed professional counselor. You know, I don't have a clinician status. So the onus then is on me to have invested in knowing what is available. So I, you know, and I feel very comfortable knowing, okay, this is going to be a peer support type call. This may require a clinician. This may require a psychologist from our employee assistance program or one of our Assist the Officer Foundation clinicians. This may be something as simple as somebody needs help with personal finances. You know, they may be struggling with a sick child, any number of things, but having an understanding of the resources is equally as important as being a person where somebody else feels like they can go have a conversation. And so
do you vet those resources in advance? Like, how do you check out the referrals you're going to make to the person that's in crisis?
Absolutely. So one of the neatest things about where we are as a department right now in Dallas is we're consolidating all of the resources into kind of this, we're calling it DFR Cares. So DFR Cares, we've used the analogy of a wagon wheel. Okay, you've got a wagon wheel with a hub and with spokes, and it's a wheel. And so we wanted to have centralized point of intake in our department where somebody interfaces with DFR Cares. And from there, there's almost an endless number of spokes in the wagon wheel that we can afford the member based on what's going on with them. And absolutely, we vet them and we've got some good ones. Part of the problem is a lot of the members have no idea what's out there. So what we sought to do was really simplify the intake process and you know, we now have a peer support coordinator who is actually a full-time employee. It's a firefighter who is now running that hub. And it's amazing. It, you know, where we were 10 years ago is just night and day. And to now know that there is somebody at our training facility in an office who's handling this, who is vetting the resources, who knows, you know, is really a subject matter expert on this. And so I can connect with that individual in our department, and then they can help me find either the resources that I can take back to my member, or they can become the one that walks side by side. You know, one of the spokes is now, you know, the department now has an actual full-time psychologist, a clinician, which is just huge. You know, it's for so many years we relied on, well, just call the chaplain, you know, just call the chaplain, or, you know, this nebulous, you know, 800 number for EAP.
Right.
As I'm sure you know, Bonnie.
Yes.
You know, and so now, you know, it's a totally different model where we really, we have a good group of people with tenure, who really know what the resources are. Because at the end of the day, I don't show up to fight a fire not knowing what's on my fire engine.
Right.
You know, I know what's in each of those compartments and when they're needed and why they're used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a separate model.
I'm going back to the analogies with the fire service.
They're great. They work perfectly.
Yeah. They're really good ones. I think it's phenomenal that you have a full-time clinician and a full-time paid peer support position. I mean, in an ideal world, we'd love to see that in every single department and agency, no matter how big or how small, but the need is there, but you're leading by example. And it's very inspiring for me to hear what you're doing, and your poor chaplain needs a chaplain after all that.
Absolutely.
I mean, having a clinician there, it's just such a home run. So,
yep, we're just a work in progress. We're trying to be proactive in so many areas. Sadly, a lot of this effort has been reactive, but whatever it takes is what it takes. And here we are today in just, you know, an amazing place. It doesn't discredit any of the tragic events that have led us to this moment in our department's history. But it's just an exciting time. You know, there's just so much work to be done. And our medical director, years ago, you know, we had a planning session when we were in the infancy of this effort. And he summed it up perfectly. He said, no firefighter should lose their job or take their life because we have failed to provide help. And that sums up the entire initiative here. You know, we have a responsibility to support our employees, you know, and to make sure that that help is available. And that's what every one of us who has raised their hand to be part of this effort, that's what drives us.
Hang on, Bodie. 32 years of emotion.
This job isn't a joke, and it can hurt you.
How does yoga or meditation help with that?
Coming to terms with who you are.
You know, nobody calls us because they're having a good day.
It's really the suicide that becomes a huge issue.
People are more trustworthy with the dog.
Sleep deprivation helps them either be better or worse.
Completely secretive when we started this.
So it's pretty much taboo.
Take care of the people next to you.
First responders really being open about what they're struggling with.
If we know that, let's raise awareness.
Brings you together to talk about it, and it tells you you're not alone.
This episode is sponsored by the Angio Foundation.
Well, it's great because your mission is the same as ours, you know, and the whole reason we do this podcast is because we want to raise awareness and save lives. And even if one person watching this has a life saved because of that, then it's all worth it on our end. The statistics, as you know, are baffling just from our intro. And we don't put our head on our pillow at night until we feel like we've done enough on our end. So there's anything more we could do to raise awareness, please let us know. Other guests you think we should have. We're all on the same team here.
Absolutely. And I truly applaud your efforts. It's just, you know, I've had an opportunity to do podcasts before and have actually had people contact me from other parts of the country and just say, saw what you guys are doing. Can you tell me a little bit more about it? You know, and, you know, the fire service is notoriously slow to change, but the more we talk about it, the more we shed some light on the darkness, the faster that change is going to happen. But I want to go back to what I said. I think it's so critical that we leverage the why, but why all of us took this job, because that makes it a really easy sell. You know, we took this job to help other people. We didn't take this job to help only the public. We took this job to help all people. And this is that moment when we get to do that within as well as outside of our organizations.
Well, Christian, I'd love to jump back into the shoes of a company officer, because there's been some interest with some of my colleagues who really, you know, run into some challenges with situations like we're talking about. And I'd love to get your perspective on this. So we've got somebody who's, you know, there's a cry for help. There's a need to help them in a crisis, and we're getting them the help. But how do we follow up on that, and how do we handle it? As we've talked about, we're in a 24-hour work living situation. We're a family, and so everybody may have an idea that something's going on with, you know, our friend, our brother, our sister. How do we handle that in terms of make sure that that person is getting help and follow up and make sure that they're improving through this crisis?
Sure. It's a tricky question, because we have to, while we do have a very unique work environment, we also have to respect privacy. We have to respect the fact that somebody may not want to mix personal with work. Mm-hmm. And so that's a fine line. I think follow up, you know, there's a couple of ways to look at that. As a company officer, I have to follow up from how my member is doing from a performance standpoint. So having a regular check-in from a let's call it a performance improvement standpoint is one way to do that. And I do that normally, you know, it's maybe a weekly or a monthly check-in. And how are you doing? So just kind of a formal process. But I think the follow-up is also about just having conversations, you know, investing a little more time in that person on a day-to-day basis. You know, we all have the tricks that we use. You know, it could be providing that member a leadership opportunity, task them with leading something with the work group. It may be something as special as inviting them to be part of the peer support team. You know, one of the biggest strengths that most of us have who have joined this effort is that we've walked through something in our own lives. And so as you see somebody begin to walk through something they've gone through, I'd say putting them in a role where they get to use their experience and provide strength and hope to others as a result of the experience they've had is a great way to stay plugged in. You know, the last thing we want to do is say, hey, go talk to this person or go make an appointment or call this number and then not follow up. So I think it's essential that we have some kind of, you know, regular, measurable follow-up for any interaction that we have. And, you know, and I will look at my phone and say, you know, it's been a while since I've talked to so-and-so, and just send them a text message, say, hey, you want to get together for coffee? You know, or go visit them at the station. You know, as a battalion chief, I have the ability to go do that. And then, you know, if the member is willing, another avenue that I've found to be effective is include their family in their process. You know, many of us invite our families up to the fire station to have dinner. Sometimes that occurs during a holiday if you're working on Thanksgiving or Christmas. But one of the ways to track with somebody is to also invest in getting to know their family. You know, I've offered my own family to other firefighter families to chat. And that family support, you know, is actually very important because it allows that network to have some support as well, because they have their own experience and their own story about their own firefighter that is probably very similar. They just don't know that there are other families out there who are, you know, part of the firefighter life and family and the unique aspects of that person's job that they end up bringing home.
You mentioned this, but I think the confidentiality piece is paramount, because if that is ever breached, the trust is gone. And yep. The word gets out like wildfire if someone can't be trusted. So I think in particular for leaders to know when you're sitting with your people, know when you're wearing your captain or chief hat, and know when you're wearing your I care about you hat, because there is a difference. And I think that a lot of good meaning leaders, when they're a little too heavy on the discipline or punishment and less on the I care about you, people aren't going to open up, right?
Sure.
It's a really fine line to walk. But I know when I was in that position with people, I would say, look, this is totally confidential. It's not being shared. This is just you and me, you know, Bonnie and Joe talking right now. Mm-hmm. No one else. And I felt like that was very disarming in a good way and gave people an opening, you know.
Yep.
So maybe for leaders to keep that in mind as well.
I think that's essential. And anybody who has been at a fire station dinner table knows that there's a lot of chatter, a lot of gossip. You know, the one thing that's guaranteed when you're off, when you have a day off and your crew is working, is that they're probably going to be talking about you. Hey, can you believe what Christian posted on his social media? You know, and generally it's good natured. You know, the concept of agitation in the fire service, it's one of our love languages, but it's also really important to differentiate exactly the way you said, Bonnie. You know, hey, we're having a conversation right now about something that is very personal and meaningful and important. And a lot of times I'll make sure they know, hey, this is Christian talking to Jason. This is not chief or captain talking to fire rescue officer. And so I make sure to differentiate. But I also, you know, when serving in a peer support role, one of the neat things that we have is, you know, peer support teams are actually protected by state law in Texas under confidentiality clauses. So that's a really unique aspect of the conversation as well. And we make sure to tell the member, hey, this is a confidential, protected under state law, and it can also be anonymous. And afford them that comfort and that security that comes from that. And I go as far as to say, this is not going to be something that will ever be discussed at the fire station table. Mm-hmm. And to make sure. And I think all of us understand the seriousness of the work enough that we keep that sacred and we respect that. It's not the stuff of conversations with others. And obviously, you know, as with any information, if somebody is deemed to be a threat to themselves or others, there are times obviously when that confidentiality must be broken for somebody's own safety.
Sure.
But in general, I think the members do feel comfortable and do feel safe having those conversations because we have deliberately made sure to let them know that it's a very sacred conversation that's being had.
It's a key point. Well, Christian, I feel like we only scratched the surface of this. We could go on probably for another couple of hours, and perhaps we'll revisit it to continue this important topic. In the meantime, where can people find you out there, social media or the internet or any other way?
Sure. Personally, you can find me on LinkedIn. I've, as part of my own mental health, I've stayed off of social media. but as far as reaching out, you know, you're free to make my information available to anybody who wants to have a conversation, who wants to brainstorm, trade experiences or best practices. So I'll grant you permission to share my email and phone number, you know, and, you know, look us up, come see us in Dallas. We are always trying to improve what we're doing. You know, our vision obviously is to be an industry leader, in this effort, to have other departments model themselves after what we're doing. But at the same time, we're learning as we go. And this is a perpetual work in progress. But, you know, like I said at the beginning, we're excited to be having the conversations. And it really has, it's been an honor to be a part of the dialogue today with both of you.
Well, likewise, we are so pleased to be able to share your experience and what the amazing work that you're doing there at Dallas and the whole department as a whole.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you, Christian. It was a pleasure meeting you.
Likewise.
Thank you.
Please remember, like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, the Responder Wellness Inc. page. Also, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, BBS Radio, Spotify, and our website, respondertv.com. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.